From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Well, it was $1,000 a hot dog last night at an unprecedented fundraiser for George W. Bush. We'll look at the money behind Bush and Gore, how George Bush made millions after leading the drive to build a new stadium for his Texas Rangers, and as allegations about Bush's drug use swirl, we'll look at Al Gore's drug connections, his closest advisor's ties to U.S. drug companies. The MacArthur Genius Grants were given out. We'll speak with one of the winners, who's challenging private money in public campaigns. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A major victory and defeat for the disability rights movement. In a major coup for mentally disabled Americans, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that mentally disabled residents of a Georgia state hospital have a right to receive their special state-funded programs and services outside hospital walls and fences. The Supreme Court, in a ruling, though cheered by business groups and denounced by advocates for the disabled, yesterday clamped limits on how far the Americans with Disabilities Act reaches into the nation's workplaces. The landmark law does not automatically protect people with impairments which can be readily corrected, the justices said in ruling against two nearsighted pilots, a mechanic with high blood pressure and a truck driver with poor vision. The closely watched cases amount to the High Court's most comprehensive review to date of the law passed by Congress 9 years ago to protect disabled people from employment discrimination. The Center for an Accessible Society, a disabilities advocacy group, called the court's action a profound setback. Chai Feldblum, a Georgetown University law professor who helped write the ADA, said these decisions create the absurd result of a person being disabled enough to be fired from a job, but not disabled enough to challenge the firing. The Senate yesterday overwhelmingly approved a bill authorizing the payment of more than $800 million in back dues to the United Nations, but cutting future American contributions to the organization. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees estimates that more than 209,000 refugees, the vast majority of them ethnic Albanians, have returned to Kosovo since NATO troops began deploying in the Yugoslav province on June 12th. Meanwhile, efforts to clear thousands of landmines from Kosovo have come too late for Burim Perteshi. The 12-year-old ethnic Albanian boy has already lost a leg. He was playing with friends last week in a valley near his village, 18 miles north of Prizren. Suddenly, he stepped on a landmine. He now lies in a bed in a hospital where doctors treat up to 5 people a day with serious landmine injuries. Doctors said since last Tuesday, when ethnic Albanians began returning to the area from refugee camps in Macedonia and Albania, 18 people have been brought to their hospital with landmine-related injuries. Meanwhile, the United States continues to resist calls to ban anti-personnel landmines. The United States still has not signed on to the 1997 mine ban treaty. The U.S. Senate yesterday unanimously passed an amendment urging a tougher U.S. policy in support of a free and fair U.N.-sponsored vote in Indonesian-occupied East Timor. The Senate said the Clinton administration should immediately intensify their efforts to prevail upon the Indonesian government and military to take steps to end anti-independence militia violence and to allow East Timorese who've been living in exile to return to East Timor to participate in the ballot. The vote on East Timor's political status is scheduled for August. Yesterday, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan announced that the vote will be postponed from August 8th to later in August because of the violence that continues to occur in East Timor. And the East Timor Action Network has urged the World Bank to continue to withhold so-called social safety net funds for Indonesia as evidence mounts that the funds are being misused in East Timor. Leaked local East Timorese government documents show the funds are to be used to pay civil defense units, some of which incorporate paramilitary militias whose violent activities threaten to derail the August vote on East Timor's political status. The documents show the funds are also to be used to actively campaign in violation of the agreement setting up the vote. In Washington, Democrats are threatening to bring the Senate to a standstill until there's a debate over their proposals to guarantee new rights to people covered by HMOs. Those proposals include guaranteed minimum hospital stays after mastectomies, access to clinical trials, and the right to see doctors outside an insurance company's network. The federal government has authorized Western Union to handle wire transfers of money to Cuba, making it easier for exiles to send funds to friends and relatives. The State Department said this week that Western Union will be able to process the transfers starting on July 8th. And do you eat food that's grown organically? Are you sure? Organic food is a $5 billion a year industry, but it's based mostly on trust, and some insiders say the trust isn't always justified. The issue of correct labeling of organic foods is on the agenda in Washington.
What time is it?
It's mango time.
The number one time special of the year. It's mango time, mango time. In Africa, the big rain come again. It's mango time, mango time.
It's mango time,
funny. Yes, you feel so good when you look up in the trees. And it's mango time, mango time. See everywhere the big green and yellow juicy. It's mango time, it's mango time.
It's mango time, mommy.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Texas Governor George Bush huddled yesterday with members of Congress on his first trip to the nation's capital since forming his presidential exploratory committee and fattened his campaign bank account by, looks like something like $2 million at a lobbyist-studded fundraiser, which was $1,000 a plate hamburger and hot dog dinner. Bush's Washington foray also offered ammunition to Republicans hoping to defeat him in next year's presidential primaries and caucuses, and to Democrats hoping to beat him in the general election. Republicans criticized his ties to the lobbyists helping him raise money for his campaign, and Democrats blasted his links to congressional Republicans in the wake of last week's defeat of new gun control legislation. Before an enthusiastic crowd of 2,000 supporters, each giving $1,000, Bush declared, "I'm proud to be a compassionate conservative. On this ground, I will take my stand." Recent fundraising efforts have helped Bush far outpace his Republican opponents. He expects to have raised $20 million by the end of this month when the next fundraising numbers are reported to the Federal Election Commission. Well, today we're going to look at the money and support behind the Bush and Gore campaigns, beginning with George W. Bush Jr., who Molly Ivins, the Texas commentator, calls Shrub. Well, today we're going to start with George Bush by looking at how he made his money before he even ran for Texas governor. And the most significant amount of money that he raised, more than $14 million, came from his sale of the Texas Rangers, which he'd invested something like $600,000 in. But what made them so much more valuable at the time of the sale was the building of the Arlington Stadium in Texas, which Bush spearheaded the drive to finance. Today, we're going to talk about the issue of stadiums around the country. This also as congressional hearings have just been held considering a bill that's been put forward by Pennsylvania Republican Senator Arlen Specter that the public should not have to fund as much these stadiums. And we're joined by several people. Field of Schemes, How the Great Stadium Swindle Turns Public Money into Private Profit is a book published by Common Courage Books. Joining us in the studio is its authors, Joanna Kagan and Neil DeMoss. We're also joined by telephone from Texas by Jerry Politex, who is editor of Bushwatch, a website that tracks the Texas governor and presidential candidate. Jerry Politex, let's begin with you. If you can tell us about how George Bush made his money, specifically how George Bush made his money before he first ran for governor. We're going to get Jerry Politex on the phone, but as we do, Joanna Kagan and Neil DeMoss, maybe you can lay that out for us.
Well, certainly one of the things that you wouldn't think Bush made his money from is public contributions or public taxes. After all, this is the man who said just 4 or 5 years ago, we must change a welfare system that has created dependency on government. I know full well, like most Texans know, that dependency upon government saps the soul and drains the spirit. Even as Bush was saying stuff like that, though, he was a co-owner of the Texas Rangers Baseball Club, and in 1990 pushed the people of Arlington County, the people of Texas in general, to build his team a brand new publicly funded stadium, putting more than $150 million of public money into the ballpark.
Yeah, the curious thing, of course, is that Bush put in almost nothing for his ownership of a share of the team. He bought in a little under 1% of the team with his $600,000 and then was given about 10% in exchange for being managing partner. And, of course, the question is, since, you know, presumably they didn't just give him the team because of his pretty face, that was, you know, because of his political connections. And the question is how much of a role he played in getting Texas to kick in about $150 million, which then went to increase the value of the team.
Well, Jerry Politics, editor of Bushwatch, can you explain how George Bush ended up buying the Texas Rangers and then how the building of the Arlington Stadium enhanced his wealth?
Well, I'm coming in the middle of the conversation. I was cut off a minute ago. I don't know what had been previously said, but do you want me to go back as to
Yes, why don't you just give us a thumbnail sketch?
Okay, well, first of all, he had a problem previously in the oil business being accused of insider stock trading. And on the basis of that particular trade, which was cleared by the SEC, he had around $600,000 to put into the purchase of the Texas Rangers. And initially, he had a partner, William DeWitt Jr., who set up the DeWitt family, by the way, had owned the Cincinnati Reds and the St. Louis Browns. And DeWitt was a partner with Bush in the oil business. Well, anyway, George Jr. was at the White House working for his father and didn't want to stay once his father was elected and said he had things that he can do elsewhere. And, of course, what he did, obviously, was get in touch with DeWitt, and together they proposed to purchase the Texas Rangers. Unfortunately, the person who ran the league at the time thought that they needed more financial backing. And so he got DeWitt and Bush involved in someone named Rainwater. And together they formed a group that was able to purchase the Texas Rangers. The interesting thing about it was that they were able to get the city of Arlington to put up bonds for $135 million. And they only added $56 million to the deal. And the way it was structured is they were going to use ticket sales and other subsidiary sales to eventually own the stadium, and that's where the story is. I mean, they eventually will have the bonds paid off through the usual business dealings of a professional baseball team, and then they'll own the stadium free and clear, and the city of Arlington ends up having footed the bill for $156 million, and they'll end up with nothing. Also, while this is occurring, they ran into a problem with part of the land that was involved. There was a family named Mathis who felt that they weren't being offered enough by the city of Arlington for their land, and so they took it to court. And eventually they won their suit, and the judge awarded them $7 million, but the Texas Rangers refused to pay. The city of Arlington said, well, we put up our $135 million, and we have a contract that says anything over that is paid by the Texas Rangers, and they refused to pay. Now, the irony of this in terms of the Bush career is that when he was running against Ann Richards, he said, I understand full well the value of private property and its importance, not only in our state, but in capitalism in general. And I'll do everything I can to defend the power of private property and private property rights when I'm the governor of this state. And then he turns around while he's saying that, and previous to having said that, he actually had the city of Arlington condemn this family's property so they could take it over because they couldn't make a deal with the Mathis family for the property. And the president of the Texas Rangers, who was working with Bush, had written memos to that effect. So there's a problem here of hypocrisy, and that's why I call him George Doublespeak Bush, because on the one hand, he tells people about the efficacy of private property, and on the other hand, he's perfectly willing to let a governmental entity condemn land for his own use.
Jerry Politics, editor of Bushwatch, which is a website which tracks the Texas governor and now presidential candidate that has, at this point, raised $20 million. But before that, very easily was able to parlay some of his family's wealth into large sums of money from buying the Texas Rangers, putting in something like $600,000 and making something like a $14 million profit. In between the buying and the selling was the building of the Arlington Stadium, which George Bush spearheaded in terms of getting funding, a public bond that was issued. Now, this issue of stadiums is a very interesting one, and we're seeing it come up all over the country. As I said, we're joined by Joanna Kagan and Neil DeMoss, authors of Field of Schemes, How the Great Stadium Swindle Turns Public Money into Private Profit. Some people might say, well, George Bush didn't do anything illegal. He simply used the system as these money men are doing all over the country. Well, what's your response to that?
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, if you've got a few million dollars to throw around, you can easily make a windfall profit off of the public. I guess that's only fair if you're, it's a level playing field for millionaires.
Well, what about Arlen Specter, the Pennsylvania right. Republican, and the bill that he has put forward?
Right. Arlen Specter's bill is, as I understand it, to force teams and the leagues to put up a certain amount of private money. I think it's half private money if for stadiums if they're going to receive any public funds.
What's your assessment
that's,
of it?
Well, it's be better than what we have now, which is typically something like 75% to 80% private money, and then 75% to 80% public money, and then the private money often can come from things like sale of naming rights to the stadium is considered a private contribution, even if it's a stadium that's owned by the public, which is almost invariably the case. Other cases in Detroit, Mike Ilitch, who owns Little Caesars Pizza and the Detroit Tigers, is claiming that he's putting up something like a third of the private money for their new ballpark. But in fact, he was given a long-term lease on an enormous amount of downtown land that he's going to be able to use for parking and to raise revenues in other ways. So, you know, oftentimes even teams that claim they're putting in private money, a lot of that is being compensated for by other sort of public contributions. So it would be a tremendous improvement, obviously, to have a 50-50 split. The leagues are fighting it tooth and nail, as you might expect. I just saw in the paper this morning that they had a hearing on Specter's bill yesterday, and both the leagues and the players' associations came together for possibly the first time in history on this to fight against Specter's bill. So obviously he's touching a nerve.
When we come back from our break, I want to ask you why the public doesn't understand more what the public financing of these stadiums are about, and also talk about whether cities or communities where these stadiums are built do benefit in some way, do make money. We are joined by Joanna Kagan and Neil DeMoss, authors of Field of Schemes, How the Great Stadium Swindle Turns Public Money into Private Profit, and Jerry Politics, who's been following Bush for quite a while. He's editor of Bushwatch, a website that tracks George W. Bush. And we're going to be talking about Al Gore. We'll be talking about his drug connections as rumors swirl around Bush's drug use. We're going to be talking about Al Gore's closest advisors and their ties to U.S. drug companies, as everywhere he goes now in the last week after announcing for president, he is dogged by AIDS activists who are questioning his threats against African countries that manufacture cheap generic AIDS drugs. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Here in just a minute.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. You may be a rock and roll addict prancing on the stage. Money, drugs at your command. Women in a cage.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. For those of you who've been longtime listeners to Democracy Now!, you may know that we got our start in 1996 as the first daily election show in public broadcasting, or the only one at that time. And we are continuing in that tradition, bringing a grassroots voice to the issue of elections, where grassroots voices are so often excluded and basically pushed out by money and big money. The big news today, Bush in Washington, D.C., at an unprecedented fundraiser. In fact, George W. Bush's fundraiser last night in D.C. Was so crowded with lobbyists and others who were willing to fork over $1,000 a pop for a hot dog that they decided to get rid of the tables so they could fit in more people. Our guest to talk about George Bush and how he made his initial money outside of his family wealth that led him to announce for the governor of Texas are Jerry Politics, editor of Bush Watch, a website that tracks George W. Bush, also Joanna Kagan and Neil DeMoss, authors of Field of Schemes, How the Great Stadium Swindle Turns Public Money into Private Profit. What do you think, Jerry Politics, by the way, about this fundraiser in Washington and its unprecedented nature, raising $2 million at one event, bringing him to, rumor has it, $20 million? And those rumors, I think, will be confirmed at the end of the funding cycle, the end of June, when we find out from the Federal Elections Commission exactly how much he's raised.
Well, I find the whole thing absurd because, you know, he says he does black and he says white. He does hot and he says cold. And he says he's a Washington outsider. And then he operates like an insider. He wants to have it both ways. And he's so blatant about it. This is what really freaks me out. For example, he's been so anti-environment. He's been so pro-pollution simply because of where he gets his campaign money. And then he turns around and starts to talk about how he's really for cleaning up the environment.
Even though we're going to focus on the issue of stadiums, since you've said this, maybe you can just give some evidence backing it up when you say he's so pro-pollution.
Well, during his tenure as governor, he dealt with some of the largest polluters in the country. You know, Texas is first in pollution. He dealt with some of the largest polluters in the country by saying, you know, pretty please, why don't you stop this? Why don't you voluntarily say that you're going to stop polluting? And they say, oh, well, we'll think about it, and the years go on.
Stopping any kind of mandatory regulation of these.
No, it's so blatant. And then when he runs into a legislative session where the pro-environmentalists are trying to get anything passed, whatever they're able to squeeze between the cracks, then he takes credit for when he signs the bill. I mean, it's so blatant, it's unbelievable to me.
Well, let's get back to the issue of stadiums and how it is. We'll look at how Bush and others were able to push through the public funding of the stadium in Arlington and then parlay that into a multi-million dollar fortune as they sold the Texas Rangers that were playing in that stadium. But Joanna Kagan, how does this get sold to the public if, as you say, we're talking about a swindle that turns public money into private profit?
Well, it's a very clever swindle, and it's one that's been going on a long time. The main way it's sold to the public, there's several main ways it's sold to the public. Perhaps the most important is that these new facilities are important and critical to the downtown in question, so that voters in Arlington may be told that a new stadium will bring jobs, will bring a boosted economy, will bring national attention, and on and on and on. That to be a big league city, you need a big league stadium, that your current stadium, the Rangers had been playing in an old Arlington stadium, is no longer viable, that the team probably can't stick around in town unless it gets a new facility. I mean, we've seen in this sort of swindle across the country, team owners and local politicians run the gamut from threatening to leave town if they don't get a new facility, to cajoling local taxpayers, urging them that if they want more jobs for their municipality, if they want a higher tax revenue, if they want general better quality of life in their downtown, the best thing they can do is build a new stadium.
And Neil DeMoss, does it help cities or communities where these stadiums are built? Does anyone benefit?
There have been enough. I have a stack of books here of independent economic studies, people who tried to find, done different kind of macro studies and micro studies and looked at it every single different way. No independent economist has ever been able to find any evidence of significant economic benefit from any sort of sports facility. And, certainly not in proportion with the amount of public money that's being spent. Typically, when you look at these facilities, you're talking about, in terms of job creation, you're spending about $250,000 per job, which is just about the worst ratio that you can possibly find. In terms of development, I mean, they always hold up Baltimore and Camden Yards as this wonderful example of Baltimore's downtown has been brought back by the stadium. Baltimore still has something like 9% unemployment. It's one of the highest unemployment rates of any city in the country. That's typical. You maybe can move a few jobs and a little bit of a few restaurants from here to there, but it's basically just throwing money down a hole.
Jerry, politics in Texas, were there these issues raised, the issues of who is actually going to benefit?
Oh, yeah. The issues have been raised ever since it's really occurred. The Texas Observer has written quite a few articles on the subject, and so have the investigative reporters at the Houston Chronicle. Ratcliffe wrote a piece when George sold his holdings called Diamond Brilliance. And Robert Bryce in the Texas Observer wrote the governor's sweetheart deal. However, Bush, of course, is very adept at appealing to the kinds of generalizations and stereotypes that seem to sway large crowds, in Texas in particular. With respect to the Texas Rangers deal, I think one of the big things going for George was the fact that he was the son of a man who was president of the United States. And not only that, but he was recently elected, and so the campaign rhetoric was still fresh in the minds of the populace. So he had that kind of force behind him, and that's the job they gave him. He was the front man for the deal. Because he didn't bring any money to the table, surely. What he brought was the Bush name. And the New York Times magazine section this past summer talks about this at some length and mentions that he and Laura would go to the ballpark every night and sit in the same seats and wave to the crowd, and everyone knew him, and they thought he was cool. And he said he made sure that he went to the men's rooms around the stadium so that everyone would see that he was just one of the guys, and so on and so forth. So that was really his job. His job was to be a Bush, to be one of the guys. And, of course, this isn't the first time that a member of the Bush family has been used to front a business operation, nor, I would safely say, will it be the last.
Neil DeMoss.
Yeah, and to speak the importance of having someone like a George Bush involved, one of the things we discovered in researching our book was that people do understand the issues behind these deals to a great degree. People are always very skeptical and very critical of stadium deals when they're first proposed, and one of the fundamental things that teams always need to do is a huge PR campaign, spend a lot of money, often will bring in a nationally known political consultant to run the campaign, and, you know, really, you know, by PR, by advertising. Last year, there were a couple of proposals in Birmingham, Alabama, and North Carolina, where they outspent the opponents to the deal by about 20 or 30 to 1, which is about typical for these campaigns, and they still lost. People still voted them down. So when November rolled around and it was time for San Diego and Denver to vote, this time the teams made sure to outspend their opponents 100 to 1, and they won.
How are people organizing against these large stadium deals, Joanne?
We met people across the country who are actually doing really wonderful grassroots organizing. One of the things they're doing is coming across various political boundaries. So local environmentalists often oppose these deals because they're often a matter of sort of pushing through massive land use and expenditures without real research. Local school activists and others involved with genuine quality of life issues come on board in terms of a question of public priorities and where you're going to put your tax dollars. And then also libertarians and some conservatives who oppose massive public expenditures on anything are at least willing to acknowledge that corporate welfare is a kind of welfare, too. And so we've seen some really remarkable coalitions in places like Detroit and Cleveland, in cities like San Diego and Denver and Boston. Some of them have been victorious. Not all of them have. But they're tapping into the right issues.
What's one success story that you view as a success story?
I think the story of the New England Patriots trying to go to Connecticut is certainly a success story. There was a huge organized opposition movement which involved environmentalists, involved the local Reform Party, involved a lot of citizens groups, and they managed to fight that off. Minnesota is another one where they were able to block a new stadium for the Twins, and the Twins are once again coming back and trying to get a new stadium, and I just heard from people the other day that they're gearing up again to fight that. The North Carolina, there's a fair number of places actually where it's been defeated, but the problem with these stadium deals is that they're always going to keep coming back for more, so you have to sort of you have to stay organized.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us as we take a look at George Bush's record. But in this case, we're not talking about something that's illegal. We're talking about something that is happening all over the country. The question is where are the questions? And also in terms of the corporate media, are they being raised? And are these stories of coalitions that are fighting these groups getting the same kind of coverage that the people who are organizing the actual building of the stadiums are getting? Field of Schemes is the name of Joanna Kagan and Neil DeMoss's book, How the Great Stadium Swindle Turns Public Money into Private Profit. It is published by Common Courage Press. And also thank you to Jerry Politics. We will certainly be getting back to you quite often as this campaign continues to rev up. Jerry Politics, editor of Bush Watch, which is a website that tracks George Bush. Jerry, what is the website?
Oh, it's www.bushwatch.com.
That's www.bushwatch.com.
www.bushwatch.com. You got it.
Well, thanks for being with us.
Oh, glad to be here.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Well, we just took a look at Bush, and now it will be Gore's turn.
Yes, yes, Jackie, hit that ball.
He swung his bat, the crowd went wild because he knocked that ball a solid mile. Yeah, boy.
Yes, yes, Jackie, hit that ball. Satchel Paige is mellow, so is Campanello, Newcomb and Dobie too. But it's a natural fact, when Jackie comes to bat, the other team is through.
Did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? Did he hit it? Yes, and that ain't all. He's no home.
Yes, yes, Jackie's real gone.
Mm-hmm.
are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And just before we look specifically at Al Gore and what's been happening to him on the campaign trail, a very successful AIDS activist guerrilla attack on him wherever he goes that's actually getting mainstream attention, looking at his role behind the pressuring of African countries not to produce generic AIDS drugs in a continent that is hardest hit by AIDS than any in the world. We're going to go up to Boston to John Boniface. He's one of 32 winners of the MacArthur Genius Awards that were announced yesterday on John's 33rd birthday. John is a public interest lawyer and executive director of the National Voting Rights Institute. And he uses innovative litigation to re-examine campaign finance reform arguments typically debated on First Amendment grounds as he challenges big money in politics. And first of all, John, congratulations, as you've just entered the big money big leagues.
Well, thanks, Amy. I'm honored to get this award and certainly overwhelmed by it.
And also happy birthday.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, we've just been talking about George Bush and how he made some of his millions before he announced his candidacy for governor.
Right.
And that was around the issue of the Arlington Stadium in Texas that brought great value to his team, the Texas Rangers, that he was able to parlay into in something like a $14 million profit. You actually have been looking at stadiums and their role in campaigns around the country, particularly in Washington State.
Well, that's right. I mean, in Washington State, you have this classic example of how big money controls our elections when the owner of the Seattle Seahawks actually went to the state legislature and offered to pay for a special election and rent out, essentially, the election machinery to put a referendum on the ballot to get taxpayer financing for a new stadium. And then he proceeded to put $6 million+ into an ad campaign to get what eventually ended up being a very narrow margin of victory for his new stadium. And so what we really had here was ultimately the renting out, the leasing out of election machinery. Now, if we said that the precinct number 52 would now be owned by Texaco and precinct 54 is owned by Mobil, people would be up in arms. And no, we're not going to start giving out our polling booth to private interests. But that's effectively what we've done with the political process. We have said that the wealthy interests can control who finances our elections, and they're going to finance our campaigns, our political campaigns, and then we're left on election day to choose between well-financed candidate number one and well-financed candidate number two backed by the moneyed interests.
John, we don't hear very much about this behind the scenes, what goes on and the whole issue of public money in or rather private money in campaigns. Can you talk about the movement overall?
Well, I think the movement overall is a vibrant grassroots movement that's happening at the state and local level across this country. I mean, the reality of it is that movements have to be built from the grassroots up. Women did not get the right to vote because men in power all of a sudden thought it was a good idea, and African Americans did not bring down Jim Crow South because whites in power all of a sudden thought it was a good idea. It was a mass movement that took those kinds of changes, and that's what's going to happen on this issue. It's a critical issue of our time, but it's going to have to be a mass movement that brings about the kind of democratic change that's fundamentally needed for this country. Big money forces control our elections, they control our politics, and we're going to have to take it back, and we're going to have to do it from the grassroots level.
Interestingly enough, John, you have some opponents who might surprise people, like the American Civil Liberties Union.
Well, I'm an ACLU member, and I'm certainly very supportive of the organization and the stance it's taken over the years. But this is one issue on which it's dead wrong. On this issue, they say that those who have money to spend and those who have money to contribute can contribute and spend up to the sky. Their policy, their official policy, is there should be no limits whatsoever on contributions and on expenditures.
Because they say contributions equal free speech.
Right, which we believe is totally wrong. Contributions do not equal free speech. Contributions are a way of amplifying speech. It's that 8,000 megawatt bullhorn for those who have millions of dollars to amplify their speech. But money in and of itself does not equal speech. It's simply that amplifier. And those who have do not have money still have free speech rights, and that's been lost in this process as well. But equally as important, those who do not have money have equal protection rights. They have the right to an equal and meaningful vote. And we think that the proper stand that the ACLU and many other organizations on this should be that the right to vote and the right to speak falls for reform of the system, not against it.
Well, John, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And again, congratulations on your prize. The MacArthur Genius Grant will bring you $260,000. Since it was announced late yesterday afternoon, have any politicians come a-knocking?
Not yet. I certainly don't intend to give any of them to that.
John, what is your website or phone number where people can call in Boston, the National Voting Rights Institute, which is taking on the issue of private money and public campaigns and lawsuits around the country?
Sure. Thanks for asking. The phone number is 617-368-9100, and the website is www.nvri.org.
Thanks again, John Boniface of the National Voting Rights Institute. And by the way, if you don't get a chance to write down the phone numbers or websites, you can always go to our website where we have everyone included. It is at www.pacifica.org, where you can also hear any of Democracy Now!'s shows. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute.
Oh, Africa. Nobody ever apologized for when your blood ran red and your country was stolen by the whites. They took your land and your home and shut you down when you tried to refuse. But I'm sorry, Africa. I'm sorry for my people. I'm sorry what they did to you. And Africa, nobody ever said it was wrong. Though you cried long and loud in your pain when your life was gone. But no one cared, they took you as slaves and changed your life and your culture too. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people. I'm sorry what they did to you. Oh, sorry, Africa.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we move from George W. Bush to Al Gore, that's what the race looks like it's shaping up to be, although this is very, very early on and surprising to many people that so much money is rolling in at this early point in the 2000 election. Well, as George Bush was making his $2 million last night in Washington, Vice President Al Gore was in Denver, Colorado. In 7 years, nearly half the workers in America will be employed by industries that either are producers or intensive users of information technology. This is what Vice President Gore told people yesterday in Denver during his campaign swing through Colorado. The vice president released a report from the Commerce Department that said new digital technologies are changing the way Americans work, live, communicate, and play. Well, while Gore says he wants to help people in this country get on the internet, get access, as well as developing countries get online as well, there's another issue that has been dogging him in this first week of his presidential campaign, at least his announced intentions to be president. He, according to AIDS activists, wants to punish third world countries for manufacturing generic AIDS drugs. Vice President Gore is threatening trade sanctions against South Africa and other African nations that manufacture generic drugs at a fraction of the cost of U.S. drugs. Gore, who has angered members of the AIDS activist community, has ties to the pharmaceutical industry and has key drug industry people in his inner circle. We want to take a look at all of these issues, but let's start off by what has happened in this first week of Vice President Gore's campaign that I think has shocked him and sent shivers through his circles, because everything seemed to be so well planned for his announcement in Carthage, Tennessee. Just didn't realize that a group of AIDS activists were going to be in the audience, as he didn't realize for New Hampshire, but came to realize, I think, for Wall Street. We're joined right now by Eric Sawyer, who is a longtime AIDS survivor. He is a co-founder of ACT UP New York. Welcome to Democracy Now, Eric.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what this campaign is, this stealth attack on Gore?
It's basically trying to bring to the attention of the American people Gore's role in the Clinton administration's efforts to block generic production of essential medicines in developing countries. It's all about trade sanctions and how the U.S. government is using trade sanctions, withholding foreign aid, to bully foreign governments into not producing generic, cheaper versions of essential medicines, something that they have every legal right to do under the GATT Treaty and under the TRIPS Agreement of the World Trade Organization.
Well, tell us what AIDS activists are doing. What happened in Carthage and New Hampshire and Wall Street?
Basically, people went into the campaign appearances, had signs hidden, you
know,
in their clothing. Gore's greed kills, AIDS drugs for Africa has been the tag of the campaign.
And it's really getting increasing media attention. I mean, what happened in New Hampshire is quite something. The AIDS activists stood right behind Gore with a banner that says Gore greeds kills.
Yeah. Ironically, when they got to the auditorium, which only seated around 300 people, the only seats that were left available were staff seats that were directly behind him. So they quickly took them. And they had actually had their signs taken away from them, but somebody actually had smuggled in a banner in their underwear, whipped it out right at a crucial point of the speech, and it was dead on camera.
So this was the banner which Gore stood in front of as he announced his intentions to be president of the United States. Well, now behind the scenes, the Gore team is frantically working to somehow squelch what is going on. You yesterday had a meeting with Sandy Thurman, who is the AIDS czar in Washington. I should say, as in the case with the George Bush segment today, we tried to get the George Bush campaign on to represent George Bush's point of view. They said they wouldn't be available. And also we tried to get Sandy Thurman on, but she said she had appointments this morning. But what came of that meeting? Clearly, you got the meeting because of the AIDS activists, the AIDS activist activities.
Well, actually, we'd been trying to get a meeting for a while to talk to Sandy about the issue of compulsory licensing and the South Africa issue and the government's involvement in denying access to medicines there. But to our surprise, we were actually not only meeting with Sandy Thurman, but we were joined by a Thomas Rawshirt, who is actually Vice President's Foreign Affairs spokesperson, and by Clark Ray, who is soon to be Tipper Gore's chief of staff at the Gore campaign. So there, in addition to that, we are also joined by the gay and lesbian liaison, Richard Socarides, to the Clinton administration. So clearly the meeting, its profile and the players were significantly heightened by the demonstration.
I should say we also invited Richard Socarides on. I spoke to him yesterday, but he referred me to Senator Thurman, who wasn't able to come on. So this has taken on extreme significance. We're also joined on the telephone by Rob Weissman. Rob is the co-author of Corporate Predators and co-director of Essential Action, which is Essential Information, which is Ralph Nader's corporate accountability group. Rob Weissman, you've been looking at corporate connections of Vice President Gore and how they tie into his position on pressuring African countries.
Right. Well, interestingly, with your comment about Gore's claiming that the future of the economy is going to be based on the Internet, Gore himself has unusually tight ties to the high technology industry. He's probably the first presidential candidate who really represents high tech forces. And there's a whole swirl of lobbyists and close advisors and some staff members of Gore, many of whom who sort of grew up with him politically in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, who left him,
many of whom left him to go work in the private sector and cash in as lobbyists with access to the White House, people like Peter Knight and Roy Neal and former Representative Tom Downey. A lot of those people got rich representing high-tech companies in computers, telecommunications, and pharmaceuticals. And we think that the pharmaceutical lobbyist friends have had a big influence on the policy that's unfortunately come out of Gore's office. So, for example, Tony Podesta, who has the benefit for him of being both a confidant of Al Gore and the brother of John Podesta, the chief of staff at the White House, runs a firm, Podesta.com, that's one of the major drug company lobbying firms. So we think that's one of the conduits of the pharmaceutical industry's positions to the Gore White House, to the Gore office in the White House. And there's also a guy, David Beyer, on Gore's staff, who's been a long-time employee in the pharmaceutical industry, and we think that he's helped shape policy, although he suggests otherwise.
David Beyer actually used to be the vice president for Genentech, one of the major U.S. pharmaceutical companies. He was their chief lobbyist, VP of Governmental Affairs. We also should mention Peter Knight, a former Sherling Plough lobbyist, who is one of Gore's chief fundraisers.
And Tom Downey represents Merck.
As well. So he's clearly surrounded himself by a lot of people with strong ties to the drug industry.
How, Rob Weissman, do you think this affects what Vice President Gore is doing? I know, although he doesn't have people representing him here today, their argument is the drug companies are pressing him to go much further. In fact, isn't it true that they've brought suit against – who have they sued?
Well, they've brought suit in South African courts against the – to try to stop the implementation of South Africa's law that's designed to make generic drugs, including generic – HIV-AIDS drugs available to the population there. But they've also rented out the U.S. Trade Representative's office to enable the U.S. government to bring direct bilateral trade pressure and apply different kinds of sanctions against South Africa. The Gore administration's position is that they are actually trying, the Gore office's position, that they're trying to restrain the U.S. Trade Representative's office from doing even harsher things that they would prefer to do. That's sort of a strange position for the number two person in government to say, well, they would be doing worse if I didn't hold them back. He is a policymaker, and if he thinks policy is wrong, he ought to reverse it.
It's also interesting in those same lines that in yesterday's Baltimore Sun article, Susan Rice, Assistant Secretary for State for Africa, was asserting that Gore has led the way opposing the trade sanctions and other dramatic actions pushed for by the pharmaceutical industry. Who's running the government? Is the pharmaceutical industry running the government, or is the Clinton administration? I think the same vein of people on Gore's staff, and a lot of people say, oh, well, we're overstating Gore's role in this. It was lower people in the government or people on his staff. That may be true. A lot of what they're saying, the staff in the paper, shows their arrogance and just to what degree they're actually doing the bidding for the drug companies. That same article has quoted Leon Firth, the vice president's national security advisor, who attended meetings that the vice president held with then deputy president Mbeki, now president of South Africa, in both August of last year and February of this year. And during that, in this Baltimore Sun article, Firth is saying that Vice President Gore offered discussions about an important agreement to let South Africa shop for the best price for AIDS drugs worldwide and then import them in bulk. This offer, quote, would likely be controversial to the drug companies, Firth said, but Gore favored a mutually acceptable solution. Why is the Vice President of the United States staff people saying that their negotiations are aimed at coming up with some solution that's mutually acceptable to the drug companies and to South Africa instead of to what's mutually acceptable to the interests of the United States government and the South African government. And the fact that Leon First is saying that we are going to let South Africa shop around for drugs. He's talking about parallel importing, which every sovereign state has the right by the TRIPS Accord to do. And the UK and Holland actually get between 10% and 15% of their drugs for their national health care programs through this procedure. We wouldn't be saying that we're going to let the UK or Holland do these things, but why are we saying it about South Africa? Is it because they're poorer people of color?
Rob Weissman, you got a hold of a memo that was leaked from the State Department on the issue of how Vice President Gore, what they were using to pressure South Africa. What were some of the points raised?
Well, they told a slightly different story than the Gore office is now saying. In the memo that the State Department prepared explaining how they were bullying South Africa to change its laws, they said that they had adopted, that the entire machinery of the U.S. government was working in a full court press to stop South Africans from implementing the law and getting them to reverse the law. Then they went through the list of agencies, which was virtually every relevant agency in the U.S. government that had been involved in the process, from the Commerce Department, the State Department, the Food and Drug Association, Food and Drug Administration, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, and especially Vice President Gore. They said that Gore had brought up the issue in every meeting he had had with, in his special bilateral meetings with then Deputy President Mbeki, and that he had been very effective in pushing South Africans not to go forward with the law. They also said, interestingly, that they had employed the presidents of a variety of European countries to directly pressure South Africa as well.
We only have a minute, and I have two issues that I want to cover. One is the division in the gay community around targeting Gore right now, and the other is the AIDS, the Africa trade bill that's expected to be voted on next week. Very quickly, Eric Sawyer, the establishment gay groups are saying you shouldn't be targeting Al Gore and embarrassing him like this because he's your best hope. Gore is expected to speak at a major gay and lesbian fundraising dinner, $1,000 a plate, in Philadelphia on Monday, which is also going to be a target of protest. What's your comment to them?
Well, we think organizations like the Human Rights Campaign Fund especially should just basically keep their mouth shut on this issue. Gore has done some things, as has Clinton, to increase funding for AIDS research, care, and for housing. But these people are not involved in these trade issues whatsoever. And for them to basically give cover to the vice president just because he's done some good things for the gay community in the press is unconscionable. They are participating in the genocide of the U.S. government against people with AIDS in Africa.
And on the issue of the Africa trade bill next week, Rob Weissman?
The Africa Growth and Opportunity Act is expected to come to a vote next week in the House of Representatives. That bill would condition some mild benefits for African countries on them doing a variety of things, including adopting more strict patent laws. In other words, not doing the kinds of things that South Africa is trying to do to make drugs more available to sick and dying people. People should call the representatives right away and tell them to vote against the African Growth and Opportunity Act and to support the Hope for Africa Act, which would take a reverse policy on this question.
To get more information, where can people go? Let's start with Eric Sawyer.
Actually, the best site is the website of the Consumer Project on Technology. That's a Ralph Nader site headed by Jamie Love, www.cptech.org.
And Rob Weissman.
For information on the trade bill, they can go to www.tradewatch.org. If they're interested in our book, they can go to www.corporatepredators.org.
And thank you very much for being with us. That's Rob Weissman, author of Corporate Predators, and Eric Sawyer, longtime AIDS survivor and one of those involved with these guerrilla actions against Al Gore. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, the number to call is 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
When your life was a gone, but no one cared, they took you slave. And change your life and your culture too.